it yourself. The last is preferable if possible. You'll also be a much better manager because you'll be supervising people who are doing a job you've done before. You'll know when to criticize and when to support. At 37 Signals, we didn't hire a system administrator until one of us had spent a whole summer setting up a bunch of servers on his own. For the first 3 years, one of us did all of our customer support. Then we hired a dedicated support person. We ran with the ball as far as we could before handing it off. That way, we knew what we were looking for once we did decide to hire. You may feel out of your element at times. You might even feel like you suck. That's all right. You can hire your way out of that feeling, or you can learn your way out of it. Try learning first. What you give up in initial execution will be repaid many times over by the wisdom you gain. Plus, you should want to be intimately involved in all aspects of your business. Otherwise, you'll wind up in the dark, putting your fate solely in the hands of others. That's dangerous. Hire when it hurts. Don't hire for pleasure. Hire to kill pain. Always ask yourself, what if we don't hire anyone? Is that extra work that's burdening us really necessary? Can we solve the problem with a slice of software or a change of practice instead? What if we just don't do it? Similarly, if you lose someone, don't replace him immediately. See how long you can get by without that person in that position. You'll often discover you don't need as many people as you think. The right time to hire is when there's more work than you can handle for a sustained period of time. There should be things you can't do anymore. You should notice the quality level slipping. That's when you're hurting. And that's when it's time to hire, not earlier. Pass on great people. Some companies are addicted to hiring. Some even hire when they aren't hiring. They'll hear about someone great and invent a position or title just to lure them in. And there they'll sit, parked in a position that doesn't matter, doing work that isn't important. Pass on hiring people you don't need, even if you think that person's a great catch. You'll be doing your company more harm than good if you bring in talented people who have nothing important to do. Problems start when you have more people than you need. You start inventing work to keep everyone busy. Artificial work leads to artificial projects, and those artificial projects lead to real costs and complexity. Don't worry about the one that got away. It's much worse to have people on staff who aren't doing anything meaningful. There's plenty of talent out there. When you do have a real need, you'll find someone who fits well. Great has nothing to do with it. If you don't need someone, you don't need someone. Strangers at a cocktail party. If you go to a cocktail party where everyone is a stranger, the conversation is dull and stiff. You make small talk about the weather, sports, TV shows, etc. You shy away from serious conversations and controversial opinions. A small, intimate dinner party among old friends is a different story, though. There are genuinely interesting conversations and heated debates. At the end of the night, you feel you actually got something out of it. Hire a ton of people rapidly, and a strangers at a cocktail party problem is exactly what you end up with. There are always new faces around, so everyone is unfailingly polite. Everyone tries to avoid any conflict or drama. No one says, "This idea sucks." People appease instead of challenge. And that appeasement is what gets companies into trouble. You need to be able to tell people when they're full of crap. If that doesn't happen, you start churning out something that doesn't offend anyone, but also doesn't make anyone fall in love. You need an environment where everyone feels safe enough to be honest when things get tough. You need to know how far you can push someone. You need to know what people really mean when they say something. So hire slowly. It's the only way to avoid winding up at a cocktail party of strangers. Resumes are ridiculous. We all know resumes are a joke. They're exaggerations. They're filled with action verbs that don't mean anything. They list job titles and responsibilities that are vaguely accurate at best. And there's no way to verify most of what's on there. The whole thing is a farce. Worst of all, they're too easy. Anyone can create a decent enough resume. That's why half-assed applicants love them so much. They can shotgun out hundreds at a time to potential employers. It's another form of spam. They don't care about landing your job. They just care about landing any job. If someone sends out a resume to 300 companies, that's a huge red flag right there. There's no way that applicant has researched you. There's no way he knows what's different about your company. If you hire based on this garbage, you're missing the point of what hiring is about. You want a specific candidate who cares specifically about your company, your products, your customers, and your job. So how do you find these candidates? First step, check the cover letter. In a cover letter, you get actual communication instead of a list of skills, verbs, and years of irrelevance. There's no way an applicant can churn out hundreds of personalized letters. That's why the cover letter is a much better test than a resume. You hear someone's actual voice and are able to recognize if it's in tune with you and your company. Trust your gut reaction. If the first paragraph sucks, the second has to work that much harder. If there's no hook in the first three, it's unlikely there's a match there. On the other hand, if your gut is telling you there's a chance at a real match, then move on to the interview stage. Years of irrelevance. We've all seen job ads that say 5 years of experience required. That may give you a number, but it tells you nothing. Of course, requiring some baseline level of experience can be a good idea when hiring. It makes sense to go after candidates with 6 months to a year of experience. It takes that long to internalize the idioms, learn how things work, understand the relevant tools, etc. But after that, the curve flattens out. There's surprisingly little difference between a candidate with 6 months of experience and one with 6 years. The real difference comes from the individual's dedication, personality, and intelligence. How do you really measure this stuff anyway? What does 5 years of experience mean? If you spent a couple of weekends experimenting with something a few years back, can you count that as a year of experience? How is a company supposed to verify these claims? These are murky waters. How long someone's been doing it is overrated. What matters is how well they've been doing it. Forget about formal education. I have never let my schooling interfere with my education. Mark Twain. There are plenty of companies out there who have educational requirements. They'll only hire people with a college degree, sometimes in a specific field, or an advanced degree, or a certain GPA or certification of some sort, or some other requirement. Come on. There are plenty of intelligent people who don't excel in the classroom. Don't fall into the trap of thinking you need someone from one of the best schools in order to get results. 90% of CEOs currently heading the top 500 American companies did not receive undergraduate degrees from Ivy League colleges. In fact, more received their undergraduate degrees from the University of Wisconsin than from Harvard, the most heavily represented Ivy school with 9 CEOs. Too much time in academia can actually do you harm. Take writing, for example. When you get out of school, you have to unlearn so much of the way they teach you to write there. Some of the misguided lessons you learn in academia. The longer a document is, the more it matters. Stiff, formal tone is better than being conversational. Using big words is impressive. You need to write a certain number of words or pages to make a point. The format matters as much or more than the content of what you write. It's no wonder so much business writing winds up dry, wordy, and dripping with nonsense. People are just continuing the bad habits they picked up in school. It's not just academic writing either. There are a lot of skills that are useful in academia that aren't worth much outside of it. Bottom line, the pool of great candidates is far bigger than just people who completed college with a stellar GPA. Consider dropouts, people who had low GPAs, community college students, and even those who just went to high school. Everybody works. With a small team, you need people who are going to do work, not delegate work. Everyone's got to be producing. No one can be above the work. That means you need to avoid hiring delegators. those people who love telling others what to do. Delegators are dead weight for a small team. They clog the pipes for others by coming up with busy work. And when they run out of work to assign, they make up more, regardless of whether it needs to be done. Delegators love to pull people into meetings, too. In fact, meetings are a delegator's best friend. That's where he gets to seem important. Meanwhile, everyone else who attends is pulled away from getting real work done. Hire managers of one. Managers of one are people who come up with their own goals and execute them. They don't need heavy direction. They don't need daily check-ins. They do what a manager would do. Set the tone, assign items, determine what needs to get done, etc. But they do it by themselves and for themselves. These people free you from oversight. They set their own direction. When you leave them alone, they surprise you with how much they've gotten done. They don't need a lot of hand-holding or supervision. How can you spot these people? Look at their backgrounds. They have set the tone for how they've worked at other jobs. They've run something on their own or launched some kind of project. You want someone who's capable of building something from scratch and seeing it through. Finding these people frees the rest of your team to work more and manage less. Hire great writers. If you are trying to decide among a few people to fill a position, hire the best writer. It doesn't matter if that person is a marketer, salesperson, designer, programmer, or whatever. Their writing skills will pay off. That's because being a good writer is about more than writing. Clear writing is a sign of clear thinking. Great writers know how to communicate. They make things easy to understand. They can put themselves in someone else's shoes. They know what to omit. And those are qualities you want in any candidate. Writing is making a comeback all over our society. Look at how much people email and text message now rather than talk on the phone. Look at how much communication happens via instant messaging and blogging. Writing is today's currency for good ideas. The best are everywhere. It's crazy not to hire the best people just because they live far away. Especially now that there's so much technology out there making it easier to bring everyone together online. Our headquarters are in Chicago, but more than half of our team lives elsewhere. We've got people in Spain, Canada, Idaho, Oklahoma, and elsewhere. Had we limited our search only to people in Chicago, we would have missed out on half of the great people we have. To make sure your remote team stays in touch, have at least a few hours a day of real-time overlap. Working in time zones where there's no workday overlap at all is tough. If you face that situation, someone might need to shift hours a bit so they start a little later or earlier in the day so you're available at the same time. You don't need 8 hours of overlap, though. Actually, we found it preferable to not have complete overlap. You get more alone time that way. 2 to 4 hours of overlap should be plenty. Also, meet in person once in a while. You should see each other at least every few months. We make sure our whole team gets together a few times a year. These are great times to review progress, discuss what's going right or wrong, plan for the future, and get reacquainted with one another on a personal level. Geography just doesn't matter anymore. Hire the best talent, regardless of where it is. Test drive employees. Interviews are only worth so much. Some people sound like pros, but don't work like pros. You need to evaluate the work they can do now, not the work they say they did in the past. The best way to do that is to actually see them work. Hire them for a mini project, even if it's for just 20 or 40 hours. You'll see how they make decisions. You'll see if you get along. You'll see what kind of questions they ask. You'll get to judge them by their actions instead of just their words. You can even make up a fake project. In a factory in South Carolina, BMW built a simulated assembly line where job candidates get 90 minutes to perform a variety of work-related tasks. Cessna, the airplane manufacturer, has a role-playing exercise for prospective managers that simulates the day of an executive. Candidates work through memos, deal with phony, irate customers, and handle other problems. Cessna has hired more than 100 people using this simulation. These companies have realized that when you get into a real work environment, the truth comes out. It's one thing to look at a portfolio, read a resume, or conduct an interview. It's another to actually work with someone. Damage control. Own your bad news. When something goes wrong, someone is going to tell the story. You'll be better off if it's you. Otherwise, you create an opportunity for rumors, hearsay, and false information to spread. When something bad happens, tell your customers, even if they never noticed in the first place. Don't think you can just sweep it under the rug. You can't hide anymore. These days, someone else will call you on it if you don't do it yourself. They'll post about it online, and everyone will know. There are no more secrets. People will respect you more if you are open, honest, public, and responsive during a crisis. Don't hide behind spin or try to keep your bad news on the down low. You want your customers to be as informed as possible. Back in 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker spilled 11 million gallons of oil into Alaska's Prince William Sound. Exxon made the mistake of waiting a long time before responding to the spill and sending aid to Alaska. Exxon's chairman failed to go there until 2 weeks after the spill. The company held news briefings in Valdez, a remote Alaskan town that was difficult for the press to reach. The result? A PR disaster for Exxon that led the public to believe the company was either hiding something or didn't really care about what had happened. Contrast that Exxon story to the rupture of an Ashland oil storage tank that spilled oil into a river near Pittsburgh around the same time. Ashland Oil's chairman, John Hall, went to the scene of the Ashland spill and took charge. He pledged to clean everything up. He visited news bureaus to explain what the company would do and answer any questions. Within a day, he had shifted the story from a rotten oil company does evil narrative to a good oil company tries to clean up story. Here are some tips on how you can own the story. The message should come from the top. The highest-ranking person available should take control in a forceful way. Spread the message far and wide. Use whatever megaphone you have. Don't try to sweep it under the rug. No comment is not an option. Apologize the way a real person would and explain what happened in detail. Honestly be concerned about the fate of your customers, then prove it. Speed changes everything. Your call is very important to us. We appreciate your patience. The average hold time right now is 16 minutes. Give me a fucking break. Getting back to people quickly is probably the most important thing you can do when it comes to customer service. It's amazing how much that can diffuse a bad situation and turn it into a good one. Have you ever sent an email and it took days or weeks for the company to get back to you? How did it make you feel? These days, that's what people have come to expect. They're used to being put on hold. They're used to platitudes about caring that aren't backed up. That's why so many support queries start off with an antagonistic tone. Some people may even make threats or call you names. Don't take it personally. They think that's the only way to be heard. They're only trying to be a squeaky wheel in hopes it'll get them a little grease. Once you answer quickly, they shift 180 degrees. They light up. They become extra polite. Often they thank you profusely. It's especially true if you offer a personal response. Customers are so used to canned answers, you can really differentiate yourself by answering thoughtfully and showing that you're listening. And even if you don't have a perfect answer, say something. Let me do some research and get back to you. Can work wonders. How to say you're sorry. There's never really a great way to say you're sorry, but there are plenty of terrible ways. One of the worst ways is the non-apology apology, which sounds like an apology, but doesn't really accept any blame. For example, we're sorry if this upset you. Or, I'm sorry that you don't feel we lived up to your expectations. Whatever. A good apology accepts responsibility. It has no conditional if phrase attached. It shows people that the buck stops with you. And then it provides real details about what happened and what you're doing to prevent it from happening again. And it seeks a way to make things right. Here's another bad one. We apologize for any inconvenience this may have caused. Oh, please, let's break down why that's bad. We apologize. If you spilled coffee on someone while riding the subway, would you say, I apologize? No, you'd say, I'm so sorry. Well, if your service is critical to your customers, an interruption to that service is like spilling hot coffee all over them. So use the appropriate tone and language to show that you understand the severity of what happened. Also, the person in charge should take personal responsibility. An I apology is a lot stronger than a we apology. Any inconvenience. If customers depend on your service and can't get to it, it's not merely an inconvenience, it's a crisis. An inconvenience is a long line at the grocery store. This ain't that. This may have caused. The may here implies there might not be anything wrong at all. That's a classic non-apology apology move. It slights the very real problems that customers are experiencing. If this didn't affect them, you don't really need to say anything. If it did affect them, then there's no need for may here. Stop wavering. So what's the perfect way to say you're sorry? There's no magic bullet. Any stock answer will sound generic and hollow. You're going to have to take it on a case-by-case basis. The number one principle to keep in mind when you apologize, how would you feel about the apology if you were on the other end? If someone said those words to you, would you believe them? Keep in mind that you can't apologize your way out of being an ass. Even the best apology won't rescue you if you haven't earned people's trust. Everything you do before things go wrong matters far more than the actual words you use to apologize. If you've built rapport with customers, they'll cut you some slack and trust you when you say you're sorry. Put everyone on the front lines. In the restaurant business, there's a world of difference between working in the kitchen and dealing with customers. Cooking schools and smart restaurateurs know it's important for both sides to understand and empathize with each other. That's why they often have chefs work out front as waiters for a stretch. That way, the kitchen staff can interact with customers and see what it's actually like on the front lines. A lot of companies have a similar front-of-house, back-of-house split. The people who make the product work in the kitchen, while support handles the customers. Unfortunately, that means the product's chefs never get to directly hear what customers are saying. Too bad. Listening to customers is the best way to get in tune with a product's strengths and weaknesses. Think about the children's game Telephone. There are 10 kids sitting in a circle. A message starts and is whispered from one child to another. By the time it gets all the way around, the message is completely distorted, to the point where it's usually hilarious. A sentence that makes sense at first comes out the other end as, Macaroni Cantaloupe knows the future. And the more people you have in the circle, the more distorted the message gets. The same thing is true at your company. The more people you have between your customers' words and the people doing the work, the more likely it is that the message will get lost or distorted along the way. Everyone on your team should be connected to your customers, maybe not every day, but at least a few times throughout the year. That's the only way your team is going to feel the hurt your customers are experiencing. It's feeling the hurt that really motivates people to fix the problem. And the flip side is true too. The joy of happy customers or ones who have had a problem solved can also be wildly motivating. So don't protect the people doing the work from customer feedback. No one should be shielded from direct criticism. Maybe you think you don't have time to interact with customers. Then make time. Craigslist founder Craig Newmark still answers support emails today, often within minutes. He also deletes racist comments from the site's discussion boards and pesters New York City realtors who post apartments for rent that don't exist. If he can devote this kind of attention to customer service, you can too. Take a deep breath. When you rock the boat, there will be waves. After you introduce a new feature, change a policy, or remove something, knee-jerk reactions will pour in. Resist the urge to panic or make rapid changes in response. Passions flare in the beginning. That's normal. But if you ride out that first rocky week, things usually settle down. People are creatures of habit. That's why they react to change in such a negative way. They're used to using something in a certain way, and any change upsets the natural order of things. So they push back. They complain. They demand that you revert to the way things were. But that doesn't mean you should act. Sometimes you need to go ahead with a decision you believe in, even if it's unpopular at first. People often respond before they give a change a fair chance. Sometimes that initial negative reaction is more of a primal response. That's why you'll sometimes hear things like, "It's the worst thing I've ever seen." No, it's not. It's a minor change. Come on. Also, remember that negative reactions are almost always louder and more passionate than positive ones. In fact, you may hear only negative voices, even when the majority of your customers are happy about a change. Make sure you don't foolishly backpedal on a necessary but controversial decision. So when people complain, let things simmer for a while. Let them know you're listening. Show them you're aware of what they're saying. Let them know you understand their discontent. But explain that you're going to let it go for a while and see what happens. You'll probably find that people will adjust eventually. They may even wind up liking the change more than the old way, once they get used to it. Culture. You don't create a culture. Instant cultures are artificial cultures. They're big bangs made of mission statements, declarations, and rules. They are obvious, ugly, and plastic. Artificial culture is paint. Real culture is patina. You don't create a culture. It happens. This is why new companies don't have a culture. Culture is the byproduct of consistent behavior. If you encourage people to share, then sharing will be built into your culture. If you reward trust, then trust will be built in. If you treat customers right, then treating customers right becomes your culture. Culture isn't a foosball table or trust falls. It isn't policy. It isn't the Christmas party or the company picnic. Those are objects and events, not culture. And it's not a slogan either. Culture is action, not words. So don't worry too much about it. Don't force it. You can't install a culture. Like a fine scotch, you've got to give it time to develop. Decisions are temporary. But what if... What happens when... Don't we need to plan for? Don't make up problems you don't have yet. It's not a problem until it's a real problem. Most of the things you worry about never happen anyway. Besides, the decisions you make today don't need to last forever. It's easy to shoot down good ideas, interesting policies, or worthwhile experiments by assuming that whatever you decide now needs to work for years on end. It's just not so, especially for a small business. If circumstances change, your decisions can change. Decisions are temporary. At this stage, it's silly to worry about whether or not your concept will scale from 5 to 5,000 people or from 100,000 to 100 million people. Getting a product or service off the ground is hard enough without inventing even more obstacles. Optimize for now and worry about the future later. The ability to change course is one of the big advantages of being small. Compared with larger competitors, you're way more capable of making quick, sweeping changes. Big companies just can't move that fast. So pay attention to today and worry about later when it gets here. Otherwise, you'll waste energy, time, and money fixating on problems that may never materialize. Skip the rock stars. A lot of companies post help wanted ads seeking rock stars or ninjas. Lame. Unless your workplace is filled with groupies and throwing stars, these words have nothing to do with your business. Instead of thinking about how you can land a room full of rock stars, think about the room instead. We're all capable of bad, average, and great work. The environment has a lot more to do with great work than most people realize. That's not to say we're all created equal and you'll unlock star power in anyone with a rock star environment. But there's a ton of untapped potential trapped under lame policies, poor direction, and stifling bureaucracies. Cut the crap, and you'll find that people are waiting to do great work. They just need to be given the chance. This isn't about casual Fridays or bring your dog to work day. If those are such good things, then why aren't you doing them every day of the week? Rockstar environments develop out of trust, autonomy, and responsibility. They're a result of giving people the privacy, workspace, and tools they deserve. Great environments show respect for the people who do the work and how they do it. They're not 13. When you treat people like children, you get children's work. Yet that's exactly how a lot of companies and managers treat their employees. Employees need to ask permission before they can do anything. They need to get approval for every tiny expenditure. It's surprising they don't have to get a hall pass to go take a shit. When everything constantly needs approval, you create a culture of non-thinkers. You create a boss versus worker relationship that screams, "I don't trust you." What do you gain if you ban employees from, say, visiting a social networking site or watching YouTube while at work? You gain nothing. That time doesn't magically convert to work. They'll just find some other diversion. And look, you're not going to get a full 8 hours a day out of people anyway. That's a myth. They might be at the office for 8 hours, but they're not actually working 8 hours. People need diversions. It helps disrupt the monotony of the workday. A little YouTube or Facebook time never hurt anyone. Then there's all the money and time you spend policing this stuff. How much does it cost to set up surveillance software? How much time do IT employees waste on monitoring other employees instead of working on a project that's actually valuable? How much time do you waste writing rule books that never get read? Look at the costs, and you quickly realize that failing to trust your employees is awfully expensive. Send people home at 5. The dream employee for a lot of companies is a 20-something with as little of a life as possible outside of work. Someone who'll be fine working 14-hour days and sleeping under his desk. But packing a room full of these burn-the-midnight-oil types isn't as great as it seems. It lets you get away with lousy execution. It perpetuates myths like, this is the only way we can compete against the big guys. You don't need more hours, you need better hours. When people have something to do at home, they get down to business. They get their work done at the office because they have somewhere else to be. They find ways to be more efficient because they have to. They need to pick up the kids or get to choir practice, so they use their time wisely. As the saying goes, if you want something done, ask the busiest person you know. You want busy people. People who have a life outside of work. People who care about more than one thing. You shouldn't expect the job to be someone's entire life. At least not if you want to keep them around for a long time. Don't scar on the first cut. The second something goes wrong, the natural tendency is to create a policy. Someone's wearing shorts? We need a dress code. No, you don't. You just need to tell John not to wear shorts again. Policies are organizational scar tissue. They are codified overreactions to situations that are unlikely to happen again. They are collective punishment for the misdeeds of an individual. This is how bureaucracies are born. No one sets out to create a bureaucracy. They sneak up on companies slowly. They are created one policy, one scar at a time. So don't scar on the first cut. Don't create a policy because one person did something wrong once. Policies are only meant for situations that come up over and over again. Sound like you. What is it with business people trying to sound big? The stiff language, the formal announcements, the artificial friendliness, the legalese, etc. You read this stuff and it sounds like a robot wrote it. These companies talk at you, not to you. This mask of professionalism is a joke. We all know this. Yet small companies still try to emulate it. They think sounding big makes them appear bigger and more professional. But it really just makes them sound ridiculous. Plus, you sacrifice one of a small company's greatest assets, the ability to communicate simply and directly, without running every last word through a legal and PR department sieve. There's nothing wrong with sounding your own size. Being honest about who you are is smart business, too. Language is often your first impression. Why start it off with a lie? Don't be afraid to be you. That applies to the language you use everywhere, in email, packaging, interviews, blog posts, presentations, etc. Talk to customers the way you would to friends. Explain things as if you were sitting next to them. Avoid jargon or any sort of corporate speak. Stay away from buzzwords when normal words will do just fine. Don't talk about monetization or being transparent. Talk about making money and being honest. Don't use 7 words when 4 will do. And don't force your employees to end emails with legalese like, "This email message is for the sole use of the intended recipients and may contain confidential and privileged information." That's like ending all your company emails with a signature that says, "We don't trust you, and we're ready to prove it in court." Good luck making friends that way. Write to be read. Don't write just to write. Whenever you write something, read it out loud. Does it sound the way it would if you were actually talking to someone? If not, how can you make it more conversational? Who said writing needs to be formal? Who said you have to strip away your personality when putting words on paper? Forget rules. Communicate. And when you're writing, don't think about all the people who may read your words. Think of one person. Then write for that one person. Writing for a mob leads to generalities and awkwardness. When you write to a specific target, you're a lot more likely to hit the mark. 4-letter words. There are 4-letter words you should never use in business. They're not fuck or shit. They're need, must, can't, easy, just, only, and fast. These words get in the way of healthy communication. They are red flags that introduce animosity, torpedo good discussions, and cause projects to be late. When you use these 4-letter words, you create a black and white situation. But the truth is rarely black and white. So people get upset, and problems ensue. Tension and conflict are injected unnecessarily. Here's what's wrong with some of them. Need. Very few things actually need to get done. Instead of saying need, you're better off saying maybe, or what do you think about this, or how does this sound, or do you think we could get away with that? Can't. When you say can't, you probably can. Sometimes there are even opposing can'ts. "We can't launch it like that because it's not quite right," versus "we can't spend any more time on this because we have to launch." Both of those statements can't be true. Or wait a minute, can they? Easy. Easy is a word that's used to describe other people's jobs. That should be easy for you to do, right? But notice how rarely people describe their own tasks as easy. For you, it's, "Let me look into it." But for others, it's, "Get it done." These 4-letter words often pop up during debates, and also, watch out for their cousins, everyone, no one, always, and never. Once uttered, they make it tough to find a solution. They box you into a corner by pitting 2 absolutes against each other. That's when headbutting occurs. You squeeze out any middle ground. And these words are especially dangerous when you string them together. "We need to add this feature now. We can't launch without this feature. Everyone wants it. It's only one little thing, so it will be easy. You should be able to get it in there fast." Only 36 words, but 100 assumptions. That's a recipe for disaster. ASAP is poison. Stop saying ASAP. We get it. It's implied. Everyone wants things done as soon as they can be done. When you turn into one of these people who adds ASAP to the end of every request, you're saying everything is high priority. And when everything is high priority, nothing is. Funny how everything is a top priority until you actually have to prioritize things. ASAP is inflationary. It devalues any request that doesn't say ASAP. Before you know it, the only way to get anything done is by putting the ASAP sticker on it. Most things just don't warrant that kind of hysteria. If a task doesn't get done this very instant, nobody is going to die. Nobody is going to lose their job. It won't cost the company a ton of money. What it will do is create artificial stress, which leads to burnout and worse. So reserve your use of emergency language for true emergencies, the kind where there are direct, measurable consequences to inaction. For everything else, chill out. Conclusion. Inspiration is perishable. We all have ideas. Ideas are immortal. They last forever. What doesn't last forever is inspiration. Inspiration is like fresh fruit or milk. It has an expiration date. If you want to do something, you've got to do it now. You can't put it on a shelf and wait 2 months to get around to it. You can't just say you'll do it later. Later, you won't be pumped up about it anymore. If you're inspired on a Friday, swear off the weekend and dive into the project. When you're high on inspiration, you can get 2 weeks of work done in 24 hours. Inspiration is a time machine in that way. Inspiration is a magical thing, a productivity multiplier, a motivator. But it won't wait for you. Inspiration is a now thing. If it grabs you, grab it right back and put it to work. Thank you for reading our book. We hope it inspires you to rework how you do things. If so, drop a line to rework@37signals.com and let us know how it's going. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Mike Chamberlain. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Rework by Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen. Executive producers Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2010 by 37 Signals, LLC. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.